You know, oh, it's the start of something, hopefully.
This is the Garibaldi Gazette, a podcast about two-time European champions Nottingham Forest. On this episode, 4 points, independent panel, four. That's actually pretty reasonable. We'll delve into the deduction and ask what happens next. There's a lament on Luton and forever Forest, as in the number four, but with positive connotations. Working hard to crack the code as to who exactly Player A is, this is the Garibaldi Gazette. Think I've worked it out, gang. More on that later, perhaps. We're back with another show for you on what's been a big week for the club. It's me, Matt Davis Adams. I'm joined, as ever, by Arsha Ali. Hi, Arsha.
Hello, everyone. Here we are in this new reality, as Nuno described it.
Nick Miller's back with us too. Nick, have you managed to wade through every single page of the report yet?
Tragically, I have. Yeah, I have. I've read the whole thing because I had nothing better to do on whatever it was, Monday night.
It was fascinating reading, no doubt. We've got a first-time guest with us as well, long-time Forest supporter, former Supporters Trust member, former treasurer of the ladies' team. You'll know his fine work from Bandy and Shinty. It's Steve Wright. How are you doing, Steve?
Yeah, good, thanks. Thank you for having me. Quite a week to make a debut, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and I can't believe I called it the ladies' team like it was 1953, but there we go. It's been that kind of week for us. There's only one place we can start today, I'm afraid. You'll have deduced it's the deduction. So Forest have been plunged into the Premier League's bottom three after being deducted 4 points for breaching profit and sustainability rules. An independent panel delivered the verdict on Monday afternoon after they found Forest losses to 2022-23 breached the threshold of £61 million by £34.5 million. It means the Reds are now in 18th place, a point behind 17th Luton, with both teams having played 29 games. Steve, what were your initial thoughts once you heard this news?
I think my first was a sense of relief as much as anything. I think we probably got away with one, if we're honest. But on the positive side, it puts us in a good place, I think, in terms of aiming to stay up. You know, we know what we need to do. We're not actually far behind. We've not got a terrible run in. Luton have certainly got a few things on their horizon that must be a little bit nervy for them. So, yeah, I think we did okay. Let's now move on from here is probably the best way to go.
Arsha, it's kind of embarrassing, right, just to see that asterisk next to the club's name, even though we've known that it's been coming.
Yeah, I wasn't joking, you know, at the top. That was an actual quote from Nuno, which was probably the most amount of sense I've got from him in those kind of interviews. I know he doesn't like to speak in those interviews, but that was quite a sort of clear-thinking, sober way of looking at it. He, you know, I think Colin Frey it was who asked him the question, you know, what's it going to be like once you find out, you know, once you're on the other side of whatever deduction it is? And he said, you know, oh, it's going to be a new reality. We're going to finally know what we've got to do, and hopefully that will kind of wake, you know, the team up. But yeah, I mean, that asterisk, how long does that kind of stay there as it is? You know, are they going to appeal? We'll find out on Monday. Is it worth appealing? That's probably something we can discuss. Or do you just take the kind of 4 points which everyone kind of looked at, and, you know, it's one of those things where you've got a result there. You want to sort of run in the opposite direction as fast as you can, really.
The club, Nick, put out a pretty punchy statement after this. We were extremely dismayed by the tone and content of the Premier League submissions before the commissions. The statement itself seems to have gone down really well with supporters. What did you make of it?
Yeah, it would be quite odd, even though there was no mention of an appeal in that statement, it would be seem a little bit odd if they didn't appeal after the tone of that. I don't think they should appeal, but I didn't necessarily it depends what the purpose of the statement was. If the purpose of the statement was to kind of create some kind of bunker mentality and, you know, it's us against the world, lads, and try and in some kind of attempt to make the best of this situation, then I didn't particularly mind the tone of the statement, even though it did. It was quite funny that Forrest got 2 points sort of grace for, I think, what was it, exceptional cooperation, I think was the phrase that he used. And then as soon as that report came out, straight in, 2 feet, you know, no more exceptional cooperation here, lads. So I don't know whether if that can be taken into account in any appeal. I don't know. But yeah, sort of disagreed with what was kind of said in the statement or why they said it. But if it actually does have any kind of galvanising effect on anyone, then it was probably worthwhile.
Steve, Forrest had a right to be annoyed, right, about the way that these laws are being applied and the kind of scattergun nature of the whole thing, and maybe Everton do as well.
Yeah, I think there's a few things that kind of come out of it. Part of it is around that actual process, the whole setup that they've got for these rules. Part of it, I think, which, you know, we might come to later, I guess, is around the Premier League and the sort of the status of the Premier League. I think there's a bit of a split identity going on there, in my view. But I think this narrative that Forrest are putting out is quite interesting. I can understand why fans have responded well to it, this idea that we're fighting the good fight, you know, Robin Hood style, and, you know, we're the rebel city. That's all great. I mean, that's all stuff that I love. I've been banging on about that kind of thing for years. But it's a bit of a misrepresentation, really, isn't it, of what's gone on here. I think the report itself mentions that 13 clubs have been promoted in the last 10 years without parachute payments. And we're kind of saying, you know, this is an impossible situation. But 11 of those clubs stayed up when they did that. Only Middlesbrough and Cardiff actually got relegated after they were promoted without parachute payments. Just check notes. As Brentford, Leeds, Sheffield United, Wolves, Brighton, Huddersfield, Bournemouth, Watford, Leicester and Palace all stayed up having been promoted without parachute payments. 7 of them are still in the Premier League now. They may have dipped out in between times, but they're there at the moment. 2 of them were relegated in the season that we've wrote the rules. Now, maybe Leicester did the same thing as well. We'll wait and see. But I don't think we were breaking the rules in order to bring down Liverpool and Manchester City, which is kind of what we're claiming. If anything, we did it to try to unseat Brentford, Brighton, Palace, you know, the teams that are arguably the champions for the well-run club that's trying to get ahead. And also to keep back people like Luton, you know, who are again trying to improve themselves by being good at what they do rather than by throwing money at it. So I think this sort of, we needed to spend big, but we needed to do that because we were coming up having been pretty shambolically run for quite a number of years. We had a self-inflicted kind of unique situation of having hardly any players, but that was because we never expected to come up. We hadn't got any sort of plan or model for coming up and being able to sustain ourselves. So arguably, what we should have done at that point is taken the opportunity to kind of bounce back stronger by putting a more sustainable model in place. But what Marinakis is really trying to do is he's not trying to solve the problem of the Premier League and the Big Six. He's trying to make sure that Forest are a part of that problem, you know, as his club. And to be fair, a lot of fans would probably be happy with that. You know, that's a fair enough ambition. I just don't think we should try and dress it up as something that it isn't.
Yeah, as you just said there, that it was, it's not quite what the right word is, quite funny or galling or whatever, for them to use this excuse of, well, we had to spend all this money because look at the state we came up in. Well, yeah, well, whose fault is that? You know, if things had been run more sensibly, then maybe Forrest had been in the Premier League years before and we didn't have to rely on this once a generation manager to get us up. I've kind of found myself, because before it was slightly unclear as to by actually how much Forrest had breached the regulations, and when it was, you know, revealed that it was 34.5 million, I've found myself kind of totting up, well, okay, well, what's that? It's like, how much of that is Jesse Lingard's wages, and how much of that was the failure to get a shirt sponsor for most of the season? Found myself going, well, okay, the word was that the shirt sponsor for a newly promoted team is probably about £5 or £6 million a year. So that's right. That's down to 28 million. Then take Jesse Lingard's wages off, and the fee paid for whatever Forest paid for Jonjo Shelvey and blah blah blah. So again, I think we spoke about this on the pod a few weeks ago, but I found myself thinking about this and caring about it while also resenting the fact that I have to think about and care about this kind of thing and spend time when I probably should have been doing something much more kind of nourishing than looking at my laptop at sort of on Monday evening reading through this. And from a kind of professional journalistic perspective, very, really badly written report. It needed a good sub-editor to go through that. Lots of minor errors. Wasn't happy with that at all.
Again, it's that thing, isn't it? It's recruitment. I mean, like, the margin of error for promoted clubs is just, like, it's so slim, and you have to nail it. And we obviously... we went for it in a big way, and it was quite spectacular, and some of it paid off in a short term, but long term, like Steve said as well, we didn't sort of come up with any kind of plan. This was an accidental promotion, for Marinakis. It was no coincidence that there were sort of people there who aren't there anymore, and chiefly kind of Steve Cooper and to some extent Dame Murphy and people like that. But that, just going back to that statement as well, because I know everybody's sort of coming in and saying, oh, it's punchy. Like, literally everyone, even my the guy who runs the bakery around the corner, he's an Everton fan. And that was the first thing he said. Oh, that statement was punchy, wasn't it? I found it funny. I just thought it was hilarious. There was something so bonkers and something so brilliant that we distilled our entire sort of essence, a sort of recent essence of what this club is. It's idiotic, it's contradictory, the kind of sponsorship kind of fiasco, having that kind of inflated self-worth, and then to sort of bemoan the cartel of, the kind of this big six, yet we're the ones who vote with them at the Premier League meetings. So essentially we're that kind of gobby weakling, who kind of you're kind of safe in the knowledge that he stood behind the school bully. Do you know what I mean? And now you're sort of, railing against it. It's a bit weird, but also the kind of voting against the, the big deal, the kind of voting against the increased funding to a league you may even end up being, come August. It just kind of sums it up, that you, and also that you cooperate to a point, and then you just absolutely set the whole bin on fire. But this whole thing, it doesn't seem like it's over. There's going to be other teams who obviously will want to say, and whether they go and appeal and whatever and make it worse or whatever. But, at least we can all sit around the fire, when we're talking to our grandchildren, and we can tell them about the 2023-24 season, when Forest were deducted points. Oh, it was a great season. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Anyway.
I think it'll have its own Wikipedia page. Obviously, what they're saying outwardly, Steve, is pretty robust. Do you have any confidence internally that lessons will be learned from this?
We'll probably find out quite quickly, won't we? Because obviously we've got similar, Everton have found themselves 2 years on the trot breaking the rules. So we've got to be thinking and focus now in terms of what happens next. I know the rules are likely to change in the summer, and that's probably no bad thing, but the report certainly lays out an expectation that we come within the rules this year prior to that change. That change will be for the future seasons, not for the one we're running through at the moment. So there was some reference around the sort of expected losses that we're going to have at the moment. I mean, in reality, we need to find a £9 million PSR profit this year in order to get back in line. And it doesn't look unmanageable if you look at those numbers. It just depends a little bit on timing, I guess. And, but somebody's going to have to go. Mangala is obviously earmarked for that. But whether the intention is to make that happen prior to the end of, the current year's cycle, or whether it dips into next year, in the way that we did with Wood, maybe they're looking to do the same thing with Mangala. But somebody's going to have to go in order to top us up there, but it doesn't look unmanageable. But then the report also said that, you know, the finance director was flagging this up in September 2022, and we still didn't do anything to address it. So how confident can we be? I do think, kind of going back a little bit to this thing of the size of the breach that we had, I mean, the rules are far from perfect. Arguably, they're far from even being quite good. But I do agree with the idea, but I don't agree with the adding in our promotion bonuses to this. I think that is a bit of a misdirection. I don't think we should be being punished as a team coming up for paying bonuses for that performance. The EFL removes that from the calculations, and I don't quite understand why the Premier League brings them back in. Having said that, if we took that off, our breach is still about the same size as Everton's. So the fact that we only got a 3-point added deduction for the size of the breach, same as Everton did, feels probably like it's already been captured within the process anyway, and we haven't really been punished again for that. So in that sense, I guess that taking the punishment and accepting it, even though the rules are not great, is kind of reinforced a little bit, especially after we get 2 points for being good behaviour, which I'm not quite sure how I feel about that. I don't know whether that's too subjective to really be a genuine part of any process. I kind of, part of me feels like you should have a clear line and you should say this is the punishment and everybody gets it. But obviously it's helped us out, so fair enough.
Nick, if we round this off on something of a positive note, we felt that Forest have needed something to galvanise them of late, haven't we? It hasn't particularly been coming from the manager or the players. Maybe this will be the thing. Everton obviously got smashed by Man United, didn't they, in their first game after the news. And then I think they went on a 4-match unbeaten run where they won every game and didn't concede a goal. So that'll do.
Yeah, I mean, it's that kind of thing is obviously incredibly difficult to quantify or even kind of plan for, but needs something, doesn't it? It's not, I think we'll mercifully briefly get onto the Luton game in a bit, but something needs to be done. I don't know if the galvanising effect from, you know, the us against the world mentality can help Forest defend corners. I don't know if that's going to be how it works. But yeah, it's anything really. Anything that we can cling on to. This is the kind of state we've got. We're now in a position where we sort of know where we are. Although one thing to flag, and I don't want to unnecessarily put the willies up anyone here, but there is the prospect of the Premier League appealing this as well, because the Premier League asked for 8 points, got exactly half of that. So I don't know. I wonder whether it will be kind of in their interest to appeal, but it's not out of the question. They could appeal it, and B, of course, if Forest appeal, it could get worse. So, sorry, you wanted to end this on a positive note, didn't you? And I've taken it down the route of, so we're going to get, by Monday, we're going to get deducted 8 points instead of a... Yeah, okay, positive. Yes, this is going to galvanise. We're going to remember how to defend from corners. Nuno's going to actually pick some of the best players. He's not going to chuck on centre-backs when we're in control of games. And everything's going to be great.
All right, let's keep that positivity going as we talk about the game against Luton. Right, here's David Marple's post-match musings and then some more considered thoughts a few hours later.
Contrary to every single rational bone in my body, I started to believe we were going to win. I genuinely did. We were so close. And one of those times when, you know, we all know about sort of Luton's last minute winners, the equalisers, but it came to 87, 88. Luton were every single set piece seemed to be floating out of play. And I genuinely thought we might just do this. You know, that's how close we were. And then the whole thing changed. I sound surprised. I don't know why I sound surprised. The football gods were obviously watching. They always are. They constantly keep their eyes and ears open. And that happened. Maybe, just maybe, after Sunday, after Monday, in the cold, light heart of day, a draw isn't the worst result, perhaps. And obviously, everything's dependent next week. But blimey, we could have put it all to bed, I think. We were a minute from putting it all to bed. We had the chance and we played quite well. I think I've said that before. I think I said that most weeks, actually. But we adapted our game, I thought, and we played really well. We were aggressive in midfield. We created the chances. We stood up in defence. And then, you know what happened. If I sound bereft, listener, it's because I am. Part 2. Saturday night, and it's now Sunday morning. To quote Alan Sillitoe, as soon as you were born, you were captured by fresh air that you screamed against the minute you came out. Then you were roped in by a factory, had a machine slung around your neck. After a 3-0 home defeat, I saw Stoke City's ground labelled the Factory of Sadness. I like that. Although the factory no longer dominates our lives as it did in Victoria times, we still go to work, wherever that might be, or roped in by it, and the increasingly tortuous commute, and if by train, this will be the machine slung around your neck. The weekend comes, we seek escape, a circus, a sideshow, something to entertain us. But sometimes the football feels like the factory. It offers little or no comfort, a factory of sadness, if you will, when the fun has well and truly stopped. And so, as we enter into a 2-week break, in which the best scenario is that we somehow stay out of the relegation zone without kicking a ball, but the most likely scenario being precisely the opposite. Welcome to the waiting room of doom. It's very sad in here. Even the magazines you browse through remind you of the fate that awaits. Pictures of Blackburn and Preston and West Bromwich on a cold November Tuesday, an unending cinerama of modern factories of sadness. Winston Smith screams emit from a surgery room, and of a victim's mouth being prized open in order to force feed a diet of unrelenting midweek away games and motorway closures. Please don't make us go there again. But it's not over yet. Doesn't have to be this way. Doesn't have to be over. But we are going to have to outdo even last season's Herculean efforts in the closing stages of that season. It's going to be tough, but it can be done. Maybe? Perhaps? The performance at Luton reaffirmed my belief that we are a competent team. Yeah, Luton and not Man City, I know that. Nonetheless, we navigated our way through a tricky first half impressively. Aggressive in the tackle, no nonsense at the back, and threatening on the break. Textbook stuff, really. To be applauded in the away game of such magnitude. We deserved a win. Luton looked a spent force. They were huffing and puffing and getting nowhere fast. They were gone. The mistake I made was I allowed myself to believe. To believe that it simply couldn't happen again. To believe that despite everything, everything was just about going to be all right. Or at least better. For a while. For a bit. More fool me. I didn't hate going free at the back in the closing stages of the game. Hudson-Odoi replacing Origi meant we were still looking to grab another goal and very possibly could have done. But Morgan Gibbs-White had been our heartbeat all game, pumping vital tackles and through balls all around the body all afternoon. But the corners kept coming. The crosses kept coming. It wasn't as though it seemed inevitable they would score. But if you walk near a big puddle every day, even if you strive to avoid it, you're going to get wet. The sensible thing is to at least take a very wide berth around it, or ideally, another route. We did neither. We just crossed our fingers and hoped for the best. We watched with a stomach-churning sense of inevitability. We kindly stepped up to Luton Town, lifted them off the hook with a smile while patting them down and gently wiping the dust off them. That's how we roll. So what's to be done? Watch, wait, get angry, take it on the chin, have faith that the mostly competent performances, aside from the obvious failings, will translate into some points. Do whatever you need to do to get through it, really. Whether that's scribble believe in big letters on a bedsheet or weep into your pillow each night. Whatever works for you while we seek an exit from the waiting room of doom.
Beautifully poetic as ever from David. Thanks to him for his positivity. Sign up for his newsletter at bio.site/David Marples, or just go to his Twitter page. It's probably the easiest way to find it. Arsha, this was a tough watch, wasn't it? Because you could kind of see coming what happened in the 89th minute.
I didn't even write any notes about this game. There's a big blank space where my notes are. Usually I'm like, oh yeah. No, I mean, the less said about this, the better. It was one of those where the sort of commentators were, as they do, where they sort of manifest it. They sort of say, "Oh, and Luton, they're plucky. They'll find something in the last minute. They will, they will, they will." And you're just like, "Shut up, shut up, shut up!" And then it happens, and it's exactly as they said it would happen because there is, a body of data to tell you that on both sides, we can't defend set pieces. They stay in games till, the very end. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to just hone in on one moment, but it feels like you should. And it's not the set pieces, it's the tactical kind of change, And I haven't gone back to watch the game because I don't like doing that. I mean, come on, who does like doing that really? Really? Want to go back and just, no, it's like rewatching The Exorcist. That scared me enough. When, I shouldn't have seen it as a kid. I accidentally saw it as a kid when it was in the VHS and someone didn't take it out. And I thought something else that I shouldn't have been watching was in there, like Die Hard or something. But no, it was The Exorcist and it scared the hell out of me. So you don't want to go back and watch these horror shows. And that's what it was. It was a horror show. But that moment where he decided to match up Luton, hitherto we were absolutely kind of fine. They were sort of. They were coming at us, yes, they were, but I just didn't understand that decision, and I didn't understand him going to it as early as he did. Like, why? From that point on, it just invited them on, and I don't know if that kind of worked, and I don't know if that's another thing you can sort of file under kind of Nuno's, no-nos.
That's definitely going to be a feature on the pod in the future. Steve, what's your opinion on Nuno? We've been quite harsh on him. Is everything that's happened in recent weeks his fault, or do you offer him some mitigation?
I think there has to be a combination, not just of mitigation, but also a bit of. I find myself constantly over the years following Forrest, who roll through managers like nobody's business, constantly defending the current one because I've seen this pattern of replacement on and on and on, and that. So I'm always defending the one that's there, and then everybody says get rid, and then they bring in somebody else, and then I'm defending them, and everybody says get rid, and it just feels like a really frustrating cycle in that way. So I'm always tempted towards patience and towards trying to assess a body of work rather than a one game where something could go either way. So I don't want to pile on him too much in terms of the Luton game. We've seen before the tendency around Forest to get ahead and then just move further and further back in the pitch. So it is frustrating in that way. There were some mitigations around, Wood had got an injury. It seemed odd to keep bringing on more and more defensive-minded players, but you can kind of see where it might have been coming from. I always thought we'd get a draw. And that's just the kind of aging, kind of cynic part of me as a Forest fan. A draw seemed like the result that had less conclusion to it. So it was the most likely to happen. If we'd lost, we'd have been miserable. If we'd won, we'd have been ecstatic. But a draw just kind of leaves us not quite knowing what we're supposed to be. In hindsight now, having only got 4 points deducted, not losing looks big, in comparison to obviously winning would have been brilliant, but not losing feels like a really important thing to have happened in that game. The most frustrating thing with it, I think, was that Luton they were on their last legs by this point. They've been desperate for this break for a while. They had a shocker in the week. And you could see in that game as the goals went in at the end, the third and the fourth goal for Bournemouth, you could see that they could barely move. They were watching it happen rather than trying to do anything to stop it. So kind of shouldn't have gone that way, really, in the scheme of things. And Luton now will probably be getting the most benefit of anybody out of having this break, getting a bit of rest in the legs and potentially getting some players back. But I don't want to blame too much the manager because I want to try to give him a little bit of space to see what it is that he's trying to do and what he wants to do.
This is a crucial period for him, right, Nick? I know a lot of players will be away on international duty, but the deduction's been put in place now. We know what that is. This is his time to kind of get his ducks in a row and maybe involve his set piece coach a little bit.
The set piece coach thing is a classic bit of Forest, really. This for anyone who wasn't kind of following it, this was an appointment that was kind of rumbling on for the last few months of the Cooper era. He was obviously very keen to get someone in. I think I'm right in saying a couple of the candidates turned them down on the basis that they weren't sure who was going to be the manager in the next few months. Simon Rusk, they recruited, and very shortly afterwards, Steve Cooper was sacked. And Nuno came in, and apparently, I don't think there's anything personal against Simon Rusk, but he doesn't want to work with a separate set piece coach. So having gone to all that trouble hiring a specialist to do this, he's now sat there doing I'm not really sure what, which is a sort of, yeah, a classic bit of Nottingham Forest. Maybe Nuno will bring him in a little bit more, but he doesn't seem enormously keen to do so at the moment. But yes, this is obviously an incredibly important run of games. Hopefully some of the, I suppose, other than Taiwo, is there what other injured players are there at the moment? I think there's almost a sort of full strength squad at the moment. And Montiel's out as well. Am I missing anyone? I don't think there's anyone else, is there?
I guess we don't know about Wood. That would be the only.
Yeah. Possible. I suppose there's that. Maybe he'll, spend the international break for thinking long and hard about whether he really wants to pick Dave Okereke on the wing every week. And, you know, far be it from me to make suggestions to a very experienced football manager, but don't do that again. So some of the squad will be going to be away on international duty. Murillo won't be. The rumour is because of an administrative error. I don't know whether this is one of these kind of fake news things that everyone on the internet finds amusing, because I found it very amusing. The story was that the Brazil coach called up the wrong Murillo. He tried to call up our Murillo and ended up calling up someone who spells his name with one L. And your classic Mike Bassett, Benson and Hedges snafu. So, you know, it's one of those things that I want to believe because it's the funniest version of reality. But whether it is actually true or not, I don't know. But, you know, print the legend.
Might be an important period for Giovanni Reyna as well, Arsha. Remember him? Any chance that he might play for Forest at some point?
Wow. I mean, let's spare a thought, hey? You know, but also this Mendes influence hasn't quite sort of done anything really, has it? You know, like we've got this kind of 18-year-old kid who nobody really knew about in Portugal, who could be our only fit striker. And Gio Reyna just sort of sat there twiddling his thumbs, I don't know, playing Nintendo. I don't know what they do, these kids these days. But no, I can't really see him coming in, especially when, you know, like we've said before as well, you know, in terms of trying to catch up with all this PSR stuff, someone's in the window. And it's either Murillo or Morgan Gibbs-White, really, isn't it? You know, they're the next two big kind of big sales. But for me, I think Murillo's looking like the more likely. I don't know what it is with Morgan Gibbs-White. I don't know. Like sometimes I sort of look at him and I think, does he sort of flatter to deceive a bit? Like, is he putting the numbers on? You know, like I love Morgan Gibbs-White. You know, I love that he tries all the kind of stuff, you know, that he does, and that he seems to be on a slightly different kind of plane, you know, that he's kind of trying to get everyone up, you know, to his kind of reality or whatever. But I don't know. I just think, like, are the numbers there for the bigger clubs with him? I don't know. But for me, I definitely think it would probably be Murillo who's the next one gone.
Gibbs-White's a weird one in terms of like other people paying a lot of money for him, because firstly, Forest paid a lot of money for him, so in order to for us to consider selling him, it'd have to be a pretty hefty old bid. But he's also the sort of player who he has to be the guy. He has to be the number 10 around which everything else is built. And as you say, is he quite good enough to kind of be that for a team higher up the league than Forest? I think he's probably in that kind of slightly odd section where he is, in terms of talent, Forest's best player, but you struggle to think of what team that could afford to buy him he would fit into. He doesn't really fit into the Newcastle team. You know, James Maddison plays where he would be best at Tottenham. Arsenal aren't going to buy him. Liverpool aren't going to buy him. Villa, maybe. But again, would they pay the sort of money that would convince Forest to sell? So I actually think, if for whatever reason, whether it's relegation or whether it is, you know, just for pure financial reasons, there actually are a few players in the Forest squad that people would be interested in that would, you know, represent some kind of profit for Forest. I think you sort of forget that Callum Hudson-Odoi cost, what was it, £3 million or something like that? So you would at least double, maybe triple your money for him if you had to sell him this summer. Probably get a profit on Ilanga, who's, I think, United are probably regretting not trying to get some more money for him. Taiwo, I don't know. In theory, you should be able to get some more money for him, but whether anyone's going to trust his injury record, you don't know. Danilo, he's obviously not been quite as good as we hoped he would be this time last year. But again, maybe there's a profit to maybe in there. There's Ibrahim him. I don't know. Maybe someone would want Ryan Yates as well. They want a you know, I'm sure there are teams out there that want a wonderful yappy dog in midfield. So I think while... Jesus Christ. Sorry, my cat's just trying to fight with someone.
A person or a cat?
I think it's another cat, but who knows? Sorry. So yeah, while Murillo is the kind of the main candidate to bring in a lot of money, I actually think the squad looks okay in terms of players that they might be able to get a little bit of money for and turn a little bit of a profit on. Obviously, there are some that you're not going to get your money back for, or you know, a significant profit anyway. But there are a few there that might bring in a bit of money.
Steve, it just occurs to me, talking about all these players that we're trying to sell off, do you feel much of an emotional attachment to anybody in the squad at the moment? Because I got quite upset when Nick mentioned Ryan Yates there. But other than that, I'm kind of like, yeah, see you later.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem with the way that we go about things, the speed with which people come and go, which is another reason why I do have some sympathy for the kind of the managers that are caught up in it all as well, because I think they come and go from different people's kind of visions, is probably too grand a word, but ideas about how to do things. So the managers get caught up in that environment that isn't necessarily supporting them. But it just feels like our model, to the extent that we have a model, is to keep throwing money at it, at different people, until something works. And then when it does, claim the glory for it. But I think that it feeds into so many of the things that we talk about. And, you know, you look at the whole thing around, oh, we need a new stadium because we can't compete with these other clubs in the Premier League that have got bigger stadiums than us. And it's like, well, that's not going to close that gap. We're not going to have the income levels of Man United and, you know, Liverpool and all these teams, whatever stadium we have. We're not that type of club. What we should be doing is finding ways to be better at what we do and to make the most of the resources that we have got. And that never seems to be on our agenda. And that then feeds into this relationship with everything about the club and the team. People like Murillo, somehow they're just so good that they, you know, he crosses that divide and he's immediately, you know, he's somebody you just love to watch playing football. But it's harder for others to do that because, I mean, you look at Sangara now, he's in his first season in a new country. Who knows what he may or may not go on to do, but all you can think is, wow, £35 million was it for a midfield player? Surely that should be a transformational signing as far as we're concerned, and it just hasn't been so far. And your tendency is to, you know, to get kind of frustrated by that and then to never really connect with those people that are coming through and they really have an opportunity to make the impact you might like. I do think there's a problem, kind of hinting at earlier, there's a problem with the Premier League as far as I'm concerned, and it's a really difficult one because I'm loving being in the top flight of English football again. That absolutely is where Forest need to be. But the way that I sort of see it, having been in it now for a little while, is that the Premier League isn't really interested in being the top flight of English football because that's not where its money comes from. It's not where its prestige comes from. That all comes from being the best league in the world, the global franchise that can be sold, you know, to every country going and can bring in this massive TV audience. And that just seems irreconcilable to me. I think the only way that you can solve it is to kind of force it to take responsibility for the pyramid and try to get money flowing down. But how do you get it to do that? And even if you did, how much money is that? And how far down the pyramid does it go? Because the pyramid now goes on forever. It doesn't stop at the end of the Football League. Otherwise, do you just shut it off and say, we'll keep your best league in the world separate and we'll have a a different top flight for English football, but that means either no relegation from the Premier League or more likely a European Super League where the top few go off with their, you know, closest buddies from Europe and set up something new. Or you go for the kind of the only other option, which is a free-for-all where everybody spends what they like, does what they like, and you just say, well, it's your own risk, and if you go bankrupt and your club's dead, then so be it. You, that's what you wanted, kind of thing. That seems to be the model that our owner wants, where he can just spend what he likes, trying to get as far as he can. But that's got nothing to do with well-run clubs or sporting integrity or anything like that. It's purely to do with prioritising very rich owners who can elbow everybody out that's the way and kind of have their moment in the sun, kind of thing. And for my mind, that never, you know, that never ends well. So I kind of feel like I'm in the Premier League. I'm really excited to be in the Premier League and in the top flight, and I really hope we stay up. But the Premier League is fundamentally broken, and it's kind of almost a kind of hell on earth experience to be in it. You know, it's I don't want to go out of it. I certainly don't want to be in the Championship again, the league that nobody wants to be in. But do I really want to be in the Premier League either? That's, I think, the biggest disconnect between being a football fan, particularly a kind of older one who's seen it different to this in the past, and where we are now, and how do I connect to that team? I love the idea of being able to say we're the Rebels, we're Robin Hood, we're Nottingham, the Rebel City. If I could only believe that that was what we were doing, and we were really going to try and take down this kind of anti-football thing that has grown up around effectively global money.
All right, well, we've got a weekend off worrying about it, at least with the international break. Forest returning to action with a home game against Crystal Palace on the 30th of March. Right, we have a charity partner who you can donate to if you're able. They're called Hope Nottingham. They offer a food bank service for those in need in Notts. Here's Nigel Adams from the charity to tell us more.
Hope Nottingham runs a network of 14 community hubs and food banks across the Nottingham area, everywhere from Stapleford across to Netherfield. In the last year, we've given out 25,000 food parcels for people that are struggling with all kinds of difficulty due to cost of living, due to unemployment, due to homelessness, all sorts of different issues. But we're only able to do that because we get massive, wonderful support from so many people. And Nottingham Forest, actually, in recent years, have been really helpful to us. We've done a number of food bank collections at the ground through Nottingham Forest. And the massive support that we get across the city, we're able to bring hope to hundreds of people.
To donate, visit localgiving.org/hopenotstgg. We'll put the link in the show notes too. All right, we are nearly done for today. For our MBIT, I thought we'd finish with something a little less heavy. Today's show's been brought to you in association with the number 4. So I'd like your favourite Forest things relating to the number 4. Nick, what have you got for me?
I've got a few here. Kind of slightly, route one is squad numbers. Des Walker, I think, probably the favourite Forest player who's had the number 4. A couple of games as well. But I think I'm going to go with Peter With, who was the last Forest player to score 4 goals in a single game. That was, as I'm sure you don't need me to tell you, against Ipswich Town in 1977. So there you go.
Wow, that's a really long time ago.
It is, isn't it? The depressing thing is I found a page that lists all the times that someone in the top flight has scored 4 goals in a single game, and you do Control F, search Forest, and there's quite a few players who've scored 4 goals against Forest in there, which is fairly bleak. But yeah, Peter With, 1977. That was the last one.
Joe Lolley got 4 assists, did he, at Villa in that game?
Yeah. Actually, this is top flight, so he hasn't really taken it to. Actually, Marlon Harewood scored 4 goals in a game against
Gillingham.
Was it Gillingham? One of those clubs. a Tony Pulis club. Yeah, one of them. But yeah, the last time in the top flight was Peter With. But when was that Harewood game? 2002 ish, probably. But yeah, Lolley against, well, that would be the 5-5 against Villa.
Steve, it's difficult to look beyond Des Walker, isn't it, when you think of 4 and Forest. Was he the thing that comes to your mind, or is there anything else?
It definitely is for squad numbers, and linked to Des Walker, a big four, as far as I'm concerned, is we once had four England players on the same pitch in a game at the same time. There was Des Walker, Stuart Pearce, Neil Webb and Steve Hodge. Walker actually came on as a substitute, but they were still all there on the pitch for England at the same time. And we talk about, you know, third stars on your shirt, but can you imagine having four Forest players in an England team now? It's just, it's remarkable. I mean, that was 1988 that happened, but I mean, that was a hell of a team. And also my season ticket in 1986, the first home game of that season, we beat Charlton 4-0. So it was a nice start, nice set of expectations that was, wasn't it? We then went on to beat Villa 6-0 and we beat Chelsea 6-2 away. It was a cracking start to the season, but possibly the best run of league form in my Forest supporting life.
Well, mine is not too dissimilar. It's a 4-0 win against Manchester United.
The cup safely in their hands, but Forest players still had one problem to deal with, the manager. He's called them failures after a dismal league run. Gary Parker is about to begin to change his mind.
My very first game supporting Forest at the City Ground. All four goals came in the first 25 minutes. Gary Parker, Stuart Pearce, Nigel Clough and Steve Chettle. I mean, name a more wholesome foursome of Forest goal scorers than that. Al Waite, etc. The League Cup was paraded pre-match. What a time to be alive. Why did I ever go back, you might ask. Arsha, Forum Forest, what you got for me?
I'm going to go somewhere else. I'm going to go with a player who I remember sitting in my season ticket seat in the Brian Clough lower and thinking, hang on a sec, if I squint here, I'm kind of watching John McGovern, Simon Gillett.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know if it's just because I'm, you know, I'm unashamedly, you know, someone who holds on to that Sean O'Driscoll spell. And also, really, like, I know this sounds bad, but kind of enjoying his Doncaster teams coming and just tearing us to pieces. But I think, yeah, it's got to be Simon Gillett for me. He was such a workhorse of a player. You know, he was so compact and just really tidy on the ball. You know, I think he was sort of one of the more underrated signings from that kind of era, because I know he put the trio together. It was like he sort of got the, you know, hey boys, I'm getting the band back together. You know, because we had Coppinger, Gillett and Billy Sharp turned up as well. But every team needs a Simon Gillett, surely. And we've got one now. We've got Ryan Yates. But, you know, certainly every championship team does. And that's not a slight, you know. He is the kind of the water carrier, you know. And I know that it was like, it was Eric Cantona, I think, who said that, wasn't it? One of my heroes who said that quite disparagingly about Didier Deschamps. But, you know, I don't think it's an insult. I think you do need someone who kind of excels at that kind of simple stuff, you know, and someone who you can, we need that in this team, you know, someone who you can rely on who doesn't put the rest of the team in danger, you know, when he's on the ball, he's just sort of maximizing whatever he's got. And I know he works at Chelsea now. I think he does. He's in recruitment. But yes, Simon Gillett, if you're listening, I really enjoyed you in a Forest shirt.
I always like Simon Gillett because he is, as you say, the ultimate kind of water carrier, basics, meat and potatoes player. But he went to school with a mate of mine, and I always like to think of how good players who went on to be professional looked at school. And Simon Gillett was, you know, as you said, the player we know is your absolute basics, doesn't do anything flashy at all. At school, apparently, he was basically Zidane. You know, he as you might expect, he was kind of running rings around everyone in every single game, which for the player that we watched for, you know, an all too brief time at Forest is a very amusing thought.
That is a lot of Simon Gillett content on a podcast where we're talking about Forest getting deducted points. But hey, we're all here for it, let's be honest. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. That's been a pleasure.
Arsha and Nick, different class as ever, lads. They'll be back next week. I'm having a little break, believe it or not. So the boys will be building up to the biggie against Crystal Palace and report on whatever scandal has engulfed the club. In the meantime, join them for that if you can. Until then, you can follow us on X and we are on YouTube as well. Just search for the Garibaldi Gazette and you'll be able to find us. Leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your pods. We'd appreciate that too. Thanks for being with us today. Bye for now. We'll be right back.